Okay, so let's get started. Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us this afternoon. My name is Cynthia Nielsen. I'm a team lead of training and knowledge exchange at the Program Training and Consultation Center, and I'll be moderating today's webinar, Less Than 5 by 35, Canada's Tobacco Endgame Initiative, Why, What, How. If you're having trouble logging onto the webinar, please call the 1-800 number for PTCC. This number is 1-800-363-7822. The number is on the slide that you're seeing on your screen. A copy of the slides have been emailed to all of the participants today if you continue to experience problems. Okay, so for those of you logged onto the webinar today, you'll see that the presentation is on the right-hand side and a chat box appears on the left-hand side. Throughout the webinar today, we'll ask that you please pose your questions in the chat box. We will try to answer as many questions as we can, and please note that all of the lines have been muted for the webinar today. Okay, so we just want to get a sense of how many people or who is logged on to the call today. So please indicate how many people are attending today's webinar with you by simply clicking on the circle beside the appropriate number. Just pull that poll up. Okay, you can go ahead. Okay, that looks good. Thank you. Okay, so I'd like to introduce our presenters today. So I'm very pleased to introduce Dr. Andrew Pipe, Dr. Elizabeth Eisenhower, and Dr. Robert Schwartz. Dr. Andrew Pipe is currently Chief of the Division of Prevention and Rehabilitation at the University of Ottawa Heart Institute and a professor in the Faculty of Medicine at the University of Ottawa. He has addressed audiences in over 30 nations and has served as a physician at 12 Olympic Games. As a member of the Canadian Olympic Hall of Fame, he served as chair of the Canadian Centre for Ethics and Sport from its inception until 2003. Dr. Pipe is the recipient of honorary degrees from Queen's University, Brock University, and the University of Guelph. He was formerly vice chairman of the Board of Trustees at Queen's University, and in 2002 he was named to the Order of Canada. So welcome, Dr. Pipe.
Thank you very much.
Okay, we're also joined by Dr. Elizabeth Eisenhower. Dr. Eisenhower is currently a professor in the Department of Oncology and Medicine at Queen's University, and since 2012 has been the head of the Department of Oncology at Queen's and the Cancer Program Medical Director at Kingston General Hospital. From 1982 to 2012, she was the director of the Investigational New Drug Program of the NCIC Clinical Trials Group, has been active on a number of committees, and is currently the research lead for the Canadian Partnership Against Cancer and co-chair of the Canadian Cancer Research Alliance. Welcome, Dr. Eisenhower.
Thanks very much.
Okay, and last but not least, Dr. Robert Schwartz. Dr. Robert Schwartz is the Executive Director of OTRU and professor at the Dalai Lama School of Public Health, University of Toronto, with interests in research, evaluation, and knowledge exchange. So with no further ado, I'll turn it over to Dr. Schwartz to get us started.
Thank you very much, and it's a pleasure being here once again. Welcome to everybody. And I would say that of all the webinars that I have delivered over the past few years, this is the most exciting and I would argue perhaps the most important because it is time that we really started to take a step back and to start thinking about an end game for tobacco. And I'm going to introduce why we should need an end game for tobacco, and I suspect that for most of you on the line, you could probably skip this part. So, but what do we mean by a tobacco end game? You know, what is it that we're talking about? This is a quote from Ruth Malone, the editor-in-chief of the journal Tobacco Control. And Ruth says that the tobacco end game centers around the idea that it's necessary to move beyond tobacco control. It always bugged me, this notion of tobacco control, from the moment I started working in this field 10 years ago. Why do we want to control tobacco? No, we don't want to control tobacco. It's time to think about ending tobacco. So we're moving towards a planning on how to reach a tobacco-free future. I want to say right now, it should have been said even earlier, that when we talk about the tobacco endgame, we're talking about the commercial tobacco endgame. Okay, we're not talking about sacred tobacco or traditional tobacco as used by indigenous people. So this is the commercial tobacco endgame, and we're talking about moving away from control and towards elimination. At the same time, the second caveat I want to focus on and say very, very clearly, this is not about prohibition at all. The goal that the Endgame Steering Committee, and Elizabeth will explain all of that to you, the goal that we have set is less than 5 by 35. That means less than 5% of Canadians using tobacco by the year 2035. Less than 5 is not zero, although the notion is that if you get down to less than 5, then it will approach zero, hopefully very quickly. And we're not talking about less than 5 tomorrow. It's not overnight. It's a relatively gradual reduction to less than 5 by the year 2035. Why is this endgame if it's gradual? Well, because it's a lot faster than would have happened if we don't implement the endgame measures. So why do we need to do more than the control we've been doing until now? I mean, after all, tobacco is the success story of public health. We've reduced rates tremendously from upwards of 40% down to somewhere around 18% in 2014 and about 17% in 2015, and we don't yet know for 2016. But even though we have had tremendous success in tobacco, as you can see from the figure in this slide, the rate of decline has been pretty flat for quite a long time, for quite a long period of time. Since I entered tobacco control in 2006, arguably we have virtually no significant change in the prevalence of tobacco use, and these are figures for Ontario. So even though generally it's a gradual decline, knowing what we know about what tobacco does to us, I would argue that it is immoral. It's unconscionable that we are moving so slowly in decreasing or moving to eliminating the use of commercial tobacco. So why the tobacco endgame? It's very simple. We know it kills. There's nothing positive about using this product. We can decrease the use of tobacco. And finally, even smokers agree with us. There are virtually no smokers, or there are very few smokers who want their kids to smoke. Moreover, in surveys that we've been doing in Ontario for several years now, the vast majority of smokers tell us that they are in favor of eliminating the commercial sale of tobacco in retail outlets within 10 years. Jeff Fogg and his group at ITC recently conducted a survey in Canada demonstrating even more strongly very strong support amongst Canadians in general for moving towards a tobacco endgame. Next slide demonstrates, this is a figure that we drew using a system dynamics model called SimSmoke. And what we were able to do with that model is to forecast into the future what will be the reduction in the use of tobacco between 2012 and all the way up to 2046 under different scenarios. The top line, which is brown, is the status quo. That means that Ontario and Canada don't introduce any new tobacco control measures or don't even increase the stringency of existing tobacco control measures. As you can see, even according to that line, we continue to go down. But if we stay there by 2035, we're still going to be over 14% prevalence. Now, I'm not going to go into details about all of these lines, but just bring you down to the red line. And with the red line, that would mean that we implement all of the policies up to the maximum empower level, which is the World Health Organization based on the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control. It's sort of the minimum standard what is expected. So as you can see, Ontario hasn't done everything even in the minimum standard. But even if we did all of empower, we would still be over 10% of tobacco use in the year 2035. So why do we need more? Because it's unconscionable that 10% of people in Canada will be using tobacco in the year 2035. What we've been doing for quite a while, I would define as incremental measures. Incremental measures bring us incremental progress. And this slide demonstrates part of how that happens, because we can see that in Ontario, for quit attempts, there's virtually no change in increasing quit attempts over several years. Actually, since 2000, there is no statistically significant change in quit attempts. We know that if we are going to decrease the prevalence of tobacco use, we have to do a tremendous amount for getting current smokers to stop smoking. If we don't increase quit attempts, that's not going to happen. We've measured the long-term quit rates in Ontario, and we note that in 2014, almost 8% of past year smokers had quit for 30 days or longer. Well, that doesn't seem all that bad. But the relapse rate is about 79%. That means that in the course of a year, less than 2% of previous year smokers had quit and remained smoke-free. And that just isn't good enough if we're going to get the prevalence of tobacco use down. So I'm going to end there, and we can pause for a couple of questions if there are any at this point. Otherwise, we'll continue. And Elizabeth is going to describe how Canada's Tobacco Endgame Initiative was born and how it's progressed until now and what's going to happen moving forward.
So, Cynthia, I think, Dr. Schwartz, we don't have any questions now, so I think we're okay to move to Dr. Eisenhower.
Great.
So thanks very much, Rob, for that intro. I'm going to put a caveat. Rob was saying how the initiative was born. I would say we are still in the embryonic / fetal stage. We haven't quite given birth to a strategy yet, but the initiative is definitely a multicellular organism, I would guess. So moving along, I'm going to talk a little bit about how I got involved in this. And Rob's shown you in a bar graph some of the same data he showed. I work in the Southeast Lynn and head of oncology here. So, of course, smoking rates do lead to a lot of illness and associated deaths, as you might imagine. And our Lynn is one of the highest in Ontario. So this grabbed my attention, and I thought, well, surely we could be doing something better here, but also more broadly. And the idea for an endgame summit actually came from an experience I had about 4 years ago when I was invited to the so-called World Oncology Forum, where the question posed was, are we winning the war on cancer? One question, 100 experts, one answer, and we were 2 days stuck in this terrible place in Lugano, Switzerland, where you can see the nice picture there. Of course, I joke. But coming out of that summit was a 10-point action plan where the first of the points on that plan was to prevent preventable cancers by waging war on tobacco, by far the biggest cause of cancer death across the globe. But what wasn't clear in that action plan was what was actually said and debated was to reduce smoking rates to 0%. And this did not happen because the people in the room, all of whom were either from research or policy or patients or providers, said, we know that is impossible, so why should we bother stating it? And that got me a little bit agitated because it was hard for me to imagine that it was impossible to eliminate something that was man-made to begin with. So that festered for a while. And about 2 years ago, I had a hallway conversation with Chris Simpson, who's a cardiology colleague of mine and was then CMA president. And we got talking about this problem of smoking and our stalling, really, and dramatic decreases, and wondered whether a national summit might be helpful in focusing attention on this. And I wanted to use that kind of model that I'd experienced in Lugano, 2 days, 100 experts, one question. So we took this idea to the dean, who agreed that this was a kind of interesting construct, but neither of us were really within the tobacco control world, so we needed some real experts to weigh in. And we brought in Rob and Andrew on the phone today, as well as John Kerner, who was at that time working for the Canadian Partnership Against Cancer and very interested in prevention and knowledge mobilization. Well, this group of six, as we called ourselves, agreed that the time is right for thinking about reinvigorating our approach to tobacco control with new strategies that could move towards elimination. And we also acknowledged that it seemed our leadership role internationally had faltered a bit in the past decade, and that a national event at Queen's might be a vehicle to create some more momentum. But I don't know whether it was Rob or Andrew I have to thank for this, but they said, you know, we could have a meeting and everybody'd be all happy and go away and nothing would change. Maybe we should be thinking about more than a meeting. Maybe we should do some pre-work so that we could actually discuss some options that might be part of a strategy to get there. And from that, the end game idea was born and the work started in earnest. And Rob has also already shown you this quote from Ruth Malone, but he did make the point then as well as today that thinking is really changing internationally. Despite that sad outcome, I thought, of the Lugano summit, increasingly the notion of tobacco endgame isn't something that's airy-fairy and only some crazies think about. It is becoming mainstream, and it's really focused on no longer tolerating the assumption that control is enough and moving to drive towards a tobacco-free future. Evidence of that this was not just us saying this is all of the stretch goals by U.S. and Canadian associations, as well as at least four countries that have now stated a desire to move towards an end game by defining targets of commercial tobacco use and a time at which the end or that target is reached. And you can see here that the targets are usually in the under 5% range, down to 0% for Finland, and the dates range from 1 to 2 decades approximately to get there. So other countries are moving in this direction, and so how do we do this in Canada? How do we even begin to think about this, given that at this point we were six people who all had other day jobs, and we were really thinking about volunteering our time to move this agenda forward? So, of course, the first thing you do is you spread the pain or spread the wealth, expand the group involved, and the steering committee was struck, whose names are shown here, really representing a range of individuals involved in health and research and addiction, as well as advocacy groups and the Canadian Cancer Society as well. So the steering committee met for the first time July 8, 2015, in a nice room at the School of Public Health in Toronto, and Andrew and Rob co-chaired that meeting. And coming out of that meeting were some key decisions, agreement that the time is right for moving ahead. We debated and agreed on a target and date for Canada of less than 5 by 35. This seemed a stretch goal in many ways, but it also seemed a goal that would be feasible should all the parts get working together to make it so. There was agreement that a summit of 80 to 100 key individuals be invited from across Canada and internationally to participate in a fall of 2016 summit at Queen's, which coincided with our 175th anniversary as a university. And we also agreed that we needed to get some work done in advance to make the most of this. And we set up 8 so-called action groups or working groups that would serve as not only a vehicle to engage others, but also to put pen to paper and brain to work to think of what might be feasible for Canada to consider as potential endgame measures. And so on this slide and the next one, you see the titles of the action groups. Several of them are clustered around what types of measures in various thematic areas could be enacted to substantially limit the use and availability of tobacco, or change the product so it's not not as appealing, and so on. We did talk about how do we make the economics and business case, given we know that one of the frequently trotted out objections to moving in this direction is the loss of revenue from taxation, for example, if an end game is achieved, but also some action groups that were to consider how best to engage more broadly, to engage with Health Canada, which we did do, and to consider how best to communicate and engage public and the profession. So that work started about a year ago now, and in the 14-month gestation, again, we come back to this metaphor of birth, I guess, 50 meetings, teleconferences took place. We engaged colleagues in academia, government, non-government sectors, as well as advocates. And at the end of it all, we've produced a background paper, which we can make available, if those who haven't seen it, that included a series of chapters that were roughly based on those action group topics. We realized as we did the work of the action groups that there was a huge degree of overlap, because almost everything you do to arrive at an end game ultimately is focused on preventing new smokers and helping current smokers stop. And so arbitrarily we reassigned some of the ideas, or there was duplication of ideas, and we clustered them around the topics shown here, with at the end there being 41 options or recommendations for endgame measures and 4 overarching recommendations. And on September 30th, October 1st, 84 of us met in the Donald Gordon Center at Queen's. There's a nice picture. It was a bit chilly, but still nice venue. And the affiliations of those 84 individuals are shown here. We had a fair number, about 25%, who would be considered professionals or members from the university research environment, and that would include people like Rob and Andrew on the call. But we also had a substantial participation from FPT governments, including their health or public agencies. We had tobacco control and activist organizations, NGOs and research organizations, cancer control agencies, and so on. We did include a couple of medical officers of health, and there were individuals from the First Nations, Inuit, Métis communities in attendance, as well as students and 4 international attendees. So the goal of this summit was to strive for agreement that we actually needed to achieve a tobacco endgame in Canada, and that the work should start today, that we would debate and discuss potential interventions and transformative mechanisms through which the endgame could be achieved, and try to draw some conclusions. We did not think in a 2-day meeting we could develop a strategy, and in fact, strategy development has to be really enabled and driven by government at multiple levels, as well as NGOs and others. But this certainly had to be considered, we felt, the beginning of such strategy development. And the outcomes, we did detail selected endgame-worthy measures that were discussed, and Andrew is going to, and Rob are going to highlight some of these. There was agreement on the need to develop an endgame strategy, which I think was the thing that we felt most passionate about going into the meeting. We did achieve that coming out. A report of the proceedings is in development. I was typing on it this morning, and we're hoping to distribute that to all attendees as soon as possible. We want to bring this into a peer-reviewed domain through a CMAJ article and commentary. And we knew that this is not something we could continue to do off the side of desks of individuals, and so agreed to create an endgame cabinet comprised of organizations that actually committed to this role before the summit took place. But the idea behind the cabinet is that it would include organizations that would communicate, advocate, ensure accountability, engage with relevant government sectors, and report to public on process. And the cabinet organization membership is shown here, and we are having our first meeting in about 2 weeks' time, which will also be a transition meeting from the summit organizers to the cabinet. And before I stop talking, and I think it's about time I did, we do want to acknowledge all of the agencies and organizations that contributed funding that enabled us to invite people to the summit and pay their way. And you can see the logos of these on this slide. The Henderson Foundation is a Kingston foundation that is health-oriented and supports health-oriented work within the Kingston community. And I want to show you the dream slide of less than 5 by 35, showing where we feel we need to get to if we are going to really bend the curve of tobacco-associated disease and death in my lifetime anyway. So I'll stop there and take questions.
Dr. Eisenhower, I think we're going to continue on, and then we'll just hold questions until Dr. Pipe presents. Is that okay?
That's fine.
Okay, great. Okay, so I guess we'll turn it over to Dr. Pipe. Advance your slides here. Rob, did you want to provide a commentary here first?
Yes, I did. So we did want to talk during this session about what is the role of public health, and I do see that Eve has put a question up there saying that we know that public health has been at the forefront of getting policy changes and actions on regulation. Why not more involvement from public health and the staff involved, not just MOHs? Completely agree with that comment, and that is the purpose of the activity moving forward. So until now, it's been just a handful of people and some consultations and a summit that had a few people there. And now, since the summit, I've had several folks from public health units and similar organizations turn to me and say, well, let's see what we can do. And what we would like to do during the course of this webinar is if each of you, particularly those who work in public health, could actually think with us together about, well, what could public health be doing to move the end game forward? I do have a couple of ideas of my own, but I think that you guys are more expert, and it would be good if you start even typing in as we're talking or even at the end of the webinar, type in your ideas. You know, what is the role of public health in moving the end game forward?
Okay, thanks, Rob. Okay, so I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Pipe.
Well, thank you very much. And first, let me offer thanks from all of us to Dr. Eisenhower for the tremendous leadership that she's shown in galvanizing the activities that culminated in the summit. Dr. Schwartz, in his earlier comments, pointed out, I think, quite graphically that continued efforts to control tobacco will really will have little impact in terms of actually significantly reducing the rate of smoking and tobacco use in our community. And of course, that leads us to the very obvious conclusion that we should be doing much more in terms of the area of cessation. And we should be doing much more in terms of cessation programs delivered in settings that have not typically or characteristically been seen as environments in which cessation is addressed. In the course of the conversations at the summit, it was recognized that we need to ensure that in the workplace we provide opportunities for cessation programming. And in particular, we're gratified by the degree to which awareness of the health hazards posed by tobacco and of the need for cessation is now becoming much more commonplace in health and occupational committees, particularly in the labor union movement. We also obviously acknowledge that there are those in our community who are more vulnerable than others, and typically there are very high rates of smoking in such settings, and traditional approaches to smoking cessation have not really addressed or in any way been of assistance to those in these settings. We would make the point, and perhaps I will overstate it for emphasis, that to continue with posters or fridge magnets or public exhortations to our population that they should stop smoking is basically to deliver messages that are now falling on deaf ears. The overwhelming majority of the population we know understands why it is that they should not be smokers, and the majority of that population also would like very much not to be smokers. And so it's incumbent on us in many of the environments in which we work to ensure that we are delivering much more innovative, much more inspired and imaginative approaches to cessation. There are very obvious clinical settings. The addiction treatment setting is one where smoking behaviors are very often very firmly established. And smoking cessation is now becoming very much more commonplace than was the case previously in such treatment centers. So obviously cause for optimism. A principal thrust of our discussion in the course of the summit, however, was that cessation services should be a meaningful part of virtually every clinical environment, and that given that smokers in disproportionate numbers seek clinical services in healthcare settings, it seems almost unimaginable that we would not be providing evidence-based best practice cessation approaches in those particular settings, such that cessation services would be universal, they would be comprehensive, and they would be accessible and seen as being a standard of care. And as a consequence of cessation being a standard of care or a standard of practice, that the delivery of such programs would become a criterion for accreditation and would be seen as a performance indicator as we assess the effectiveness of the work that is being undertaken by institutions and professionals in a variety of settings. We also, and this slide repeats the point, want to emphasize that smokers don't require more information or lecture. The days of exhortational approaches to smoking cessation are long past. And really what we should be doing is providing realistic, best practice approaches to smoking cessation in the settings that I've already described should be part and parcel of a systematic cessation system. We know that the delivery of smoking cessation, unfortunately, in 2016 is still clouded by thinking and by concepts and dogmas and prejudices which date back 25 or 30 years ago. And I've taken to describing these as zombie concepts, ideas that are just very difficult to kill off in many settings. The idea that smoking is a habit, that psychiatric patients can't quit. You see some of these concepts demonstrated on this slide, and I won't read them. But the degree to which those concepts are embedded in the thinking of clinicians in particular impedes our ability to be much more effective and of much more assistance to those of our patients or those in the public who are smokers. And, of course, the presence and the prevalence of those concepts underlies the need for professional education. And unfortunately, the reality is that zombies are everywhere and young zombies are being produced consistently because it is still the case that in Canada's medical, nursing, and other health professional training programs, the likelihood that students at the undergraduate level, to say nothing of the postgraduate level, will receive meaningful instruction in contemporary approaches to smoking cessation is minimal. And this was borne out by a recent survey published by young colleague, Dr. Matthew Laranger, who points out, as a result of his finding, that smoking cessation training is largely neglected in most Canadian medical schools, and there are substantial deficits and inconsistencies in the delivery of training in the medical schools across Canada. And I would observe and state that's exactly the same kind of situation applies in nursing and schools of pharmacy. We also know that there are now present in our community three first-line therapies and that smoking cessation pharmacotherapy is a mainstay of cessation treatment. And clearly one of the challenges that surrounds the availability of this treatment is the cost that can be associated with the purchase and use of these programs. And so if we are to be systematic in our approaches to smoking cessation, we also should be systematic in ensuring that these medications are available at no cost to those who are in the grips of this, the most tenacious of addictions in our community. This next slide just underscores that in the hospital, as one example of a healthcare setting, there are large numbers of smokers, and yet the institution itself is, if you will, equipped and familiar with the kind of approaches which underpin and underlie appropriate delivery of cessation services, and clearly we should move to enhance our capacities and capabilities in those areas. We also need to ensure that clinicians of every ilk, within every discipline, do receive that specific training and recognize that we need to move away from exhortation to the offers of real assistance with appropriate follow-up. In short, systematic approaches to smoking cessation. We have systematic approaches to the management of dyslipidemia. We have systematic approaches to the management of hypertension. We have national consensus guidelines which guide practice in a variety of settings as it's applied to a variety of health states, and smoking cessation should be no different. We need to be systematic in terms of what we deliver and what we provide to individuals as they come in, who are smokers, as they come into contact with any element of the healthcare system. And it's important that health professionals in every discipline recognize that they have a fundamental responsibility to provide initial assistance with any of their patients who are smokers insofar as cessation is concerned. So that ultimately successful cessation programs will come when we change our behaviors, whether those behaviors are professional, whether those behaviors are organizational or institutional, but the degree to which we can transform those behaviors allows us to very dramatically enhance public health through enhancing the health of the patients that we see in our settings. It remains true that smoking cessation outside of childhood vaccination is still the most important preventive intervention that healthcare professionals can deliver. And it is astonishing, if one thinks about it, that smoking cessation practice has lagged in the way that it has. It's been said that smoking continues to be Canada's most prevalent, lethal, and most often neglected condition, and we need to address that shortcoming by ensuring that we become much more systematic, that we systematize programs in the community, in workplace, and clinical settings, that we establish accountability frameworks and a research strategy, that we expand the availability and integrate cessation programs, and we also ensure that there be repertorial responsibilities placed upon those who deliver healthcare services or are responsible for healthcare funding in the various settings, provinces, regions, et cetera, et cetera. And so these next few slides, just point out that we need to ensure that our political leaders collaborate to ensure a national consistent roadmap towards smoking cessation, that ministries of health need to develop a smoking cessation accountability framework within their particular systems, that the Pan-Canadian Research Funding Agencies should also cooperate with the Federal Tobacco Control Liaison Committee in developing a research roadmap, as well as strategies to ensure the funding necessary to support research, all of which will be in support of the end game. We need to implement expanded cessation programs, and we also need to ensure that ministries other than the Ministry of Health, particularly the Ministries of Labor and Social Services, ensure that they integrate smoking cessation programs and policies within their particular systems, that those agencies, institutions, academic centers, credentialing and licensing organizations who train, regulate, or fund healthcare professionals should take measures to ensure that the health professionals who they train and nurture have received appropriate training. And that the Federal Minister of Health should provide biannual reports to Parliament on the status of smoking cessation across Canada. So these are the beginnings of a variety of recommendations which will be fundamental to the creation of an endgame strategy. That work, as Dr. Eisenhower and Dr. Schwartz have noted, is now beginning, and we will continue to work, particularly in the area of cessation, in order to meet our not aspirational, but very realistic goals of trying to reduce tobacco use, commercial tobacco use across Canada to 5% by 2035.
Thank you very much, Dr. Pipe. So I have two questions that have come in. So I think I'll just open it up to the three of you to comment. So the first question is, within public health, we would like to engage more physicians in the work of treating tobacco. Any suggestions on physician engagement strategies?
So Andrew, I think it is probably you're the most experienced one to speak to this. I think the physician engagement strategies are increasing within the cancer world. For example, Cancer Care Ontario, as many of you know, has introduced a cessation intervention as part of the cancer care pathway, and we're now being assessed, each cancer center, on the metrics of compliance with that. That has started a conversation that has just never happened. It should have, but it never has. There is one of those zombie myths around, you know, it's too late to quit smoking once you have cancer. Certainly doesn't apply. The evidence suggests that cessation in that environment is as effective as some of the other interventions we pay tens of thousands of dollars for. So it is certainly important, and it's been eye-opening. But I do think the physician engagement will require champions at multiple levels within organizations, within credentialing bodies, and within educational bodies.
Yes, if I could just add to that. One of the things that I find most ironic is that we graduate every year large numbers of very idealistic, highly motivated young physicians who particularly tend to have an orientation towards programs and approaches that are preventive in nature. And unfortunately, they then enter their professional environments, I would argue, ill-equipped to address with smoking cessation and become quickly frustrated because of the what they perceive as their lack of effectiveness in this area. So there is a very real need to really enhance the training of our clinical colleagues, and not just physicians, but clinicians in every discipline, in order that they can become far more effective. I would echo Dr. Eisenhower's comments that there is this is now a train which is starting to leave the station, and as more and more settings there become expectations of the delivery of smoking cessation services, I'm somewhat optimistic that we will see improvement in this area. But I think starting at the undergraduate level and also ensuring that questions relating to smoking cessation are part of the examination, the bank of examination questions, which are used to assess, both undergraduate and postgraduate trainees, will be profoundly important in enhancing their competency in these areas, and that's something we should move toward.
I would just sort of say, reflecting on what we're seeing around the opioid crisis in Canada now, and the broad engagement of physicians in that, and maybe there's some lessons to learn about that we could apply to smoking, which arguably kills about 15 to 20 times more people per day. But it just isn't seen anymore as the same kind of crisis.
Okay, thank you very much. I think I'll just hold the next question until Dr. Schwartz presents the last section of the webinar. So Dr. Schwartz, I'll turn it back over to you.
Okay, thank you very much. I just want to situate ourselves for a moment in terms of the progress of this webinar. So Andrew has just presented one of the several chapters that are in the report that you have received as a participant in this webinar. And he talked about cessation, which is, as we all know, an integral part to reaching the end game. But for some people, it may sound like more of the same. The difference what you see in the chapter on cessation is that I think that these are really transformational ideas that we're talking about. And that is what the idea of transformational or disruptive is really what companies are thinking on endgame throughout the chapter, throughout the report. I'm going to present the findings that are in two of the other chapters in the report. We don't have time today to go through all of the chapters. The first of those is called Building on Success. And this really does seem a little bit like more of the same. What the group came to conclude is that even in some of the measures that we've already started to do, there is room for transformation. For example, if we increase tobacco taxes substantially, what do we mean substantially? Like triple the taxes that we have now so that we double the price, that would actually have a tremendous impact. And I know everybody's thinking about contraband. I can address that if you have questions, but the research is pretty clear that you're not going to get an epidemic of contraband if you do all of this properly. plain and standardized packaging is all here. So that's not done yet, but it clearly could be something that has a substantial effect on reducing tobacco use. Other things like the tobacco advertising and promotion ban, there's some holes in what we have now. On the next slide, the idea of restricting movies that depict smoking to people who are 18 years or over is really one that could have a tremendous impact on the prevalence of smoking. And we have some reports on that 37% of the kids in Ontario who start smoking do so because they've seen smoking depicted in movies. So eventually that would have a tremendous impact on the reduction of tobacco use. And finally, I'm just going to mention additional measures to reduce contraband. The governments have been paying some attention to this. Some of it seems more like lip service than actually dealing with the problem as carefully as it might be done. Moving on to the next chapter, which really is more transformative. This is about the notion of aligning tobacco supply with public health. And the first question that we ask when we talk about that is it possible in a system of free commerce where tobacco is sold legitimately as a free on the free market, the companies that work in it are legitimate companies. Can we actually align free commerce with public health? And let's see what we've done about this so far. So we all know that tobacco companies work diligently to drive up sales, and that indeed that is completely legitimate. That's what they should be doing because of legitimate legal companies in Canada. As business corporations, they have a legal obligation to maximize profits and shareholder value. So, I mean, there's no wonder that this is happening. We shouldn't be surprised by it. The question is, within this existing structure, will it be possible to actually get down to less than 5 by 35? Well, the notion of restricting free commerce to protect the public's health is not new in tobacco control. We've been doing it. We've banned advertising almost completely. We tax at very high rates. Not high enough, in my view. We ban sales to minor. Flavors are almost completely banned. We have graphic warning labels. So we don't allow completely free commerce of tobacco. And nevertheless, even with those restrictions on commerce, we know that the tobacco companies continue to reap large profits. They market their products to young people, and they are intent on keeping smokers hooked on nicotine. So most of our measures in tobacco control have been about demand reduction, trying to get people to want to smoke less tobacco, making it a little less available, a little less accessible. And, of course, the industry responds by pushing up in the other direction. So what's needed, arguably, is new and stronger restrictions on free commerce. So here are some of the things that come up in the endgame discourse. And I should note that, you know, all of these interventions that are noted here, it's not that the summit has agreed on these and said this is Canada's endgame. These are ideas out there, and moving forward, it will be up to the community to decide which of these might be pushed forward and when. Next generation regulation measures include things like limiting the retail tobacco availability. It seems rather absurd that the deadliest product that's out there for sale is available at every single corner store. I don't think that that's what we're expecting for marijuana, which is a far less harmful product overall, but I guess we can wait and see how that happens. How do we align industry behavior to public health goals and limit the supply of tobacco products that are available for sale? So, for example, there are new products like the tobacco companies are now marketing menthol capsules, even though apparently they're going to be illegal on January 1st, 2017. When we talk about the supply-side measures, these are some of the options that came up in the endgame reports. So limit retail availability by doing things like high-cost retail licensing, zoning, or potentially having tobacco-only stores. Change the tobacco supply chain by performance-based regulations, a regulated market model, or maybe this last one sounds radical, but it is about the buying out the tobacco industry and having a non-profit enterprise with a public health mandate actually be the supplier of tobacco. Finally, we have things like limiting the tobacco supply through sinking lid, cap and trade, and moratorium on new products. So moving forward, the idea is to have policy audits that ensure that all laws, regulations, policies, and programs are aligned with the public health goal of eliminating tobacco use. And finally, the notion of controlling prices at the wholesale level. And what the report says is that we don't know enough about that yet, so we need further study to talk about this. I want to end with a question about implementability. I'm not sure that's actually a word. But often when I talk about these kinds of ideas that, by the way, are not Canadian-born ideas, these are ideas that are in the literature, in the journal Tobacco Control, are being discussed all around the world in many countries that are having the same discussion we're having now about endgame. And people say, well, you know, those are crazy ideas, limiting the tobacco supply, taking over the tobacco companies, regulated market model. Are these feasible? Could we actually do it? And what I want to point out is that, you know, the government has demanded a ban or phased out other unwanted goods, like the ones listed here. The government has done it with things that actually cause a lot less harm, a lot less death than tobacco does. So I don't see any reason why we shouldn't be able to have these ideas on the table as we discuss how do we get to less than 5 by 2035. And I'm just going to leave you again with a question that I posed earlier on, that we posed earlier on. What do you think is the role of public health in all of this? And I would really be appreciated if people would start typing in some ideas that they have of what role public health can play in moving us forward toward the tobacco endgame. You know, so, you know, there are ideas like medical officers of health have a big voice, and if they were to get boards of health to adopt an endgame proclamation, I think that could be huge. We know that public health units have a clear role in advocating to the provincial government, to the federal government. It would be wonderful if health units could get something started to push the federal government, for example, as it's rejigging the federal tobacco control strategy, to get the federal government to think seriously about including an endgame goal as part of the strategy. Wouldn't it be great if all the health units could start pushing for less than 5 by 35 by the federal government? And perhaps, you know, in Ontario, the health units could be pushing the Ontario government to adopt a similar goal. And I am going to end there.
Okay, thank you very much, Dr. Schwartz. So we do have some questions coming in. So maybe I'll just get us started, and again, I'll just open them up to our three presenters to comment. Okay, so the first one is, could you comment on activity in the labor union movement to support workplace cessation and or union support of tobacco-free policy in the workplace?
Well, perhaps I'll try to answer that, given that I raised it. We've identified and worked with some members of construction unions in our region, and in terms of our trying to develop a regionalized systematic approach to smoking cessation, such individuals have now become part and parcel of the leadership of that kind of undertaking. So it's by far from being universal, but insightful occupational and health safety committees of labor unions recognize the carnage that results from smoking, and are now becoming seized with the opportunity, and I would argue perhaps the obligation, to begin to address this. And I think this is something that we can stimulate and something that we can we can count on in the future, and welcome the interest of the union movement in these issues.
Great. Does anyone else want to add to that? Okay, great. Thank you. Could you also comment on third-hand smoke exposure in the workplace as related to smoking cessation in the workplace?
Well, just a quick comment. Third-hand smoke, for those, I'm sure all of you are familiar with it, but just the idea that there are residues that ultimately come to lie in carpeting, upholstery, workplace surfaces, floors, et cetera, that in and of themselves constitute distinct health hazards. I think third-hand smoke is seen, understandably, as being of particular significance in terms of infants and toddlers who are crawling around on floors and rolling around on upholstery where these products are to be found, which is not to diminish the role that they may play in the workplace setting. But I would say that it probably is not at the forefront of concerns relating to smoking in the workplace at this point.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Okay, so in developing the Endgame Initiative, what discussions took place or are taking place around the idea of direct interventions aimed at preventing the uptake of smoking, so for example, creating a tobacco-free generation?
Right, so there's a whole chapter that was devoted to also to prevention, and the idea of the tobacco-free generation is one of the ideas that is discussed there. Another one is raising the minimum age, first perhaps to 21 and maybe eventually to 25. So yes, considerable attention has been paid also to prevention.
Okay, great. Okay, the next question. What engagement has been initiated with the Federal Minister of Health or other MPs?
So it's Elizabeth, I can take that one.
Sure.
We did invite the Federal Minister to attend the summit, but she was unable to attend on that day. We did, however, have three people from the Tobacco Control Directorate, including its Director General, Susie McDonald, attend the summit, as well as an assistant deputy minister with Health Canada who has the file. I would say that it was almost more than warm, their interest in this. They are very eager to see some of the work that has been done over the past year help inform the new tobacco control strategy for Canada. And in fact, they did delay some of their consultations to await the summit to see the to have that input into it. We do acknowledge, though, that really ultimately some of the ideas we have will require political will, which is one of the goals of the cabinet, to be comprised of organizations that can influence political will, shall we say, because even some of the measures that we talked about that we thought would be most transformative are not measures that would lie within Health Canada itself. It would require justice and finance and Health Canada to all work together. And so it does create an interplay of political factors that will require there to be influence from a number of organizations that are free to make that kind of advocacy work part of their mainstream activity.
And just a quick comment. I think it's important to clarify that those of our colleagues from Health Canada who attended the summit did so as observers.
Yes, I'm sure they would want us to say that for sure. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. There's a couple questions coming in about e-cigarettes. So do you see the rise of e-cigarettes complicating the tobacco endgame, or where does your team think electronic cigarettes fit into the 5x35?
So we had a lot of discussion about electronic cigarettes at the summit, and there is also, in the report itself, we have a section devoted to e-cigarettes. Basically, at the summit, I think the pretty broad consensus was that the focus of tobacco endgame is on ending combustibles. And if, and that's a big if electronic cigarettes are indeed something that smokers will take up instead of combustibles. And if they can quit using the e-cigarettes, then there is potential role for them in the end game. I think that we were careful in saying that the evidence about the effectiveness of electronic cigarettes as they are currently marketed is still not completely determined. But I think that what we said is that there is certainly a potential role for electronic cigarettes, depending on what they look like moving forward and what the evidence demonstrates moving forward about how smokers are able to use them to quit smoking.
Any other comments from the other two presenters on that issue?
No, I think Rob's captured that perfectly.
Okay, great. Okay, unfortunately, we have to end our webinar today. There's been so much interest and questions. I feel that ending it is a little bit, it's too bad. Hopefully, we can create some other opportunities to continue this dialogue. So I'd like to thank everyone who joined the webinar today, and a special thank you to our three presenters, Dr. Pipe, Dr. Eisenhower, and Dr. Schwartz. Following this webinar, you will be sent an email that will contain a link to an evaluation survey. If everyone could please take a few minutes to complete the evaluation, we'd really appreciate it. So just a reminder, a copy of the webinar will be available on the PTCC website. And as well, if you didn't happen to receive the background report that was emailed out this morning, please just email us at PTCC, and we're happy to send that along. So thank you very much, everyone, and I hope you enjoy the rest of your day.
Can I just make a quick comment that there will be an opportunity to discuss the Endgame Summit at the Ottawa Conference on Smoking Cessation, which is held in January. Dr. Elizabeth Eisenhower will be presenting about the Endgame Summit at that. And those of you that might have an interest in attending this session, this conference, which is purely focused on cessation, an important element of the Endgame strategy, if you contact www.ottawamodel.ca, you'll find more information about what is the next big academic program on smoking cessation in Canada.
Yeah, and I think also that we can agree to answer the questions that weren't answered. If we get a copy of them, I'm happy to work on it and to share it with Andrew and Elizabeth as well.
Thank you very much, Dr. Schwartz. I appreciate that. And thank you, Dr. Pipe. That's great. If people are interested in continuing the conversation, there is still opportunities available. Okay, well, thank you very much, everyone, and have a great day.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye. Thank you.